The most innovative companies are going further with T-Mobile for Business. The PGA of America is helping lower scores and elevate fan experiences with AI coaching tools and 5G-connected cameras. AAA is getting more drivers back on the road fast with location telematics. And the Las Vegas Grand Prix is powering race day operations with 5G connectivity, giving fans an experience at the speed they deserve. This is accelerating innovation with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now. Small business owners, this one's for you. Chase for Business and iHeart bring you a new podcast series called The Unshakables. This one-of-a-kind series will shine the spotlight on small business owners like you who faced a do-or-die moment that ultimately made their business what it is today. Learn more at chase.com/business/podcast. Chase, make more of what's yours. Chase Mobile App is available for select mobile devices. Message and data rates may apply. JPMorgan Chase Bank, N.A., member FDIC. Copyright 2024, JPMorgan Chase & Company.
I'm Ben Natifafri, host of the history show, The Last Archive, and I want to tell you about a new series we're running in our feed. It's called The Deadline. Six essays written and read by Jill Lepore, the New Yorker writer, American historian, and founding host of our show. These are incredible essays on everything from the history of cryogenics to the Silicon Valley gospel of disruption. And at the end of each essay, I interview Jill about her craft as a writer. You can listen on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Pushkin. Around month 9 or 10 of the pandemic, I noticed that a bunch of my friends and internet associates had started to read the same book. It was called Wintering: The Power of Rest and Retreat in Difficult Times. Of course, I had to get myself a copy. And imagine my delight at discovering that the author of this internationally best-selling book, Catherine May, was an autistic woman roughly my age. Not only that, but her first book, The Electricity of Every Living Thing, was all about her autistic journey of self-discovery. I can't say enough about Catherine's autism memoir. As I consumed it, I felt like I was reading about myself, which is both unsettling and thrilling. I dog-eared so many pages and sung the book's praises to everyone I knew. So how could I not try everything in my power to get Catherine on the horn? Luckily, she answered.
Hello, I'm Catherine May. I'm the author of Wintering and the Electricity of Every Living Thing. And I've known I'm autistic for about 5 years now.
You know, one thing you wrote that when you were sort of in these early stages, that you felt like you were trying to perform some kind of acrobatic act of understanding and seeing yourself from the outside. And I wonder, that's such a beautiful way of describing it. But like, tell me more about what that means, about that experience of really trying to like turn yourself over. Yeah. And look at it from a different, look at yourself from a different perspective.
And things that were maybe invisible to me. Yeah. And that's because so many of the accounts of autism, again, particularly at the time, were all from the outside. They were all like, what does an autistic person look like to a neurotypical person? Mm-hmm. You know, what are the signs, like what are the symptoms, which is, you know, a word that I'm very, very uncomfortable with using. Of autism, you know, and so it's like, it looks like this. They will seem socially awkward. They will, you know, they will not be making eye contact, but da 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 da. And so what I had to do was think, well, do I fit those descriptions? You know, do I refuse to make eye contact? And then that opens up this whole personal archaeology, because actually, yes, I can remember being very, very uncomfortable with eye contact when I was younger. And being told off for it, you know, being told off for not paying attention and not looking at someone while they were addressing me, you know, my teachers and stuff like that. But I'd buried so much because I had no consistent narrative of self available to me that would have integrated all that I was. Like, there was no story that I could have told myself in which I was a kind of valued, accepted, autistic person. Mm-hmm. And so I'd constructed a self in my mind that was like a kind of slightly wonky neurotypical who seemed traumatized but couldn't remember what the trauma, you know, like had no access to knowing what this trauma was supposed to be. And that if I could only find the right answer, you know, so I was always like reading self-help books and going to workshops, you know, and taking up new things that would sort me out, that would finally make me operate in the same way as the people around me did. And in the meantime, I was engaged in a big project of pretending I was just like them. And in fact, that I was a hyper normal one like them, you know. Right. And so, I mean, I don't know if it's the same for you, but it becomes this huge mission to unravel all that you thought you knew about yourself and to actually get back to contact with how you feel in the world, you know. And I'd suppressed a lot of sensory stuff that I didn't think I had the right to feel. Mm-hmm. And so I had to reacquaint with all of that. It was slow and it was painful.
Yeah. No, I mean, like I said, you know, we started, I mean, everything that I was reading in your book, I was like, yes, that's me. I've always, you know, it's like Lauren, dances to the beat of her own drummer, yeah. You know, it's like that type of person, right? Yeah. And it's like, but the way that you talked about your childhood, I mean, I felt very, very much the same. Like, you're a handful, you're difficult. I wanted to talk to you about your temper as a kid and I guess like what that looked like when you were a child.
Yeah. And I mean, I think probably now what I was going through would have been described as meltdowns. But again, because there was no access to that language, I was, you know, seen as a child with a temper who could kind of fly off the handle and who, you know, was naughty and difficult. And what I remember is being disapproved of by adults for losing control and feeling very different. In that sense, like very, very much like somebody who did not have control of their behavior in the way that other children did, and wondering how other children managed to pull off this amazing feat of control. Yeah.
Right. The issue is, I mean, do you think that your parents had an inkling like, oh, yeah, there's something beyond just Catherine being difficult or sensitive?
And you know what? I think, because I was brought up by my mum because my parents were divorced. But I would say that my mum was absolutely clear that there was something going on. I told her as an adult, she was like, oh, yes, that's it. You know, and she'd fought battles to try and get it understood. You know, she saw loads of things that were running differently to me and other kids. And, you know, there was a while when my school kind of suggested that I was what would have been called hyperactive at the time. You know, we'd now talk about ADHD, but, you know, I was a hyperactive child. But that didn't particularly fit, and it didn't fit my academic profile necessarily as well, because it was really obvious that I, you know, could concentrate very deeply on academic things, but that my more erratic behavior was often around sport and social events and that, you know, those things that I found really difficult. So, yeah, like my mum knew there was something, but she had nothing. And she actually rang me after the book came out and to say there was nothing that could have led me to this. You know, do you forgive me? And I was like, of course I do. I totally understand.
Oh,
you know,
that's beautiful.
She wanted to help and she knew I needed it. You know, there was nothing that she could have ever found that would have told her, here's the explanation that will make everything make sense to you.
Right. You know, I just told my parents like last week.
Oh, and how did it go?
Well, so I was diagnosed a year ago it was an enormous fear of mine, because my relationship with them has, you know, been jagged over the years. And I was really terrified. And I texted the producers. I was like, I can't do it. Like, I just can't. I can't tell them. I can't. I don't know how to do it. I don't know how, I don't have the words. Like, I don't have that relationship with them. I don't want to feel vulnerable around them. I don't feel safe around them. And then, you know, I feel like there's a part when you're telling, you know, your family, depending on the relationship you have with them, that like you are indicting them in some way that they were bad parents or something like that. And that was absolutely not what I wanted to do, because even if I had issues with parts of their parenting, what I know to be true is that autism was absolutely not talked about in America in those times, and certainly not with girls who are high achieving. Yeah. I mean, I was wondering, you know, as you were talking before, one thing I've been kind of grappling with, or one thing that sort of led me to this, there was a particular incident that kept coming up for me in therapy, like an incident that happened to me when I was a kid that I feel like sort of set in motion a lot of ways that I felt about myself or whatever. And I wonder sort of how it impacted you as a child, or if you can think about how it impacted you to be sort of, you know, the naughty one, the difficult one. Like, how did it make you feel about yourself as an adult or as a
terrible. I mean, I felt different, but also I felt like somebody who was less good. I mean, I don't mean like good at stuff, I mean good-hearted than other people.
Yeah,
because I'd been told often that I was like arrogant or aloof or abrupt, or like my mum's phrase about me was always that I didn't suffer fools gladly, which may be true. Like I was not, you know, front of the line when patience was handed out. But you get this really direct feedback about yourself that is always couched in negative terms. And then you get the indirect feedback, you know, that you're not invited to parties, that, you know, the other girls are, you know, they're getting together and they have interests that they share, and you can't access them. They don't make any sense to you. And you feel rejected. And yeah, like my self-esteem was horrible. And when I had a complete breakdown when I was 17 and I, you know, had to come out of school for a year, and I just absolutely couldn't function. It was following like an incident where I'd been bullied by some other girls over some stupid school magazine that, you know, we'd all supposed to be working on. And I'd, you know, I'd come off wrong, like I'd upset everybody. And it tipped over into me being like singled out and targeted over and over again. And my self-esteem was always, you know, it was already so low. I couldn't handle it anymore. Like, I absolutely hated myself, and I was suicidal, and I was suicidal for a long, long time.
Oh.
Yeah. And it's, you know, I'm saying that really openly because I know exactly how common that is amongst, you know, autistic people, whether or not they know it. It's that continual rejection that breaks you down.
Yeah. Yeah. I, you know, as you're talking, I'm thinking that the saving grace that I had was sport. And I was very good at sports, but also that was where you could find worth because it was very black and white. You either win or you lose.
Yeah, yeah.
And you can always keep improving. And you could always get positive attention because if you won, you it just comes with the territory.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
But I remember my coach very clearly saying to me one year in college, like, you seek out negative attention. And I was like, I don't know what you mean. And I was thinking like, oh, that's because for so much of the time in school, that's the only attention that you got.
Is negative.
You know, that's the only attention that I got was negative attention.
Yeah.
And the only way that people would pay attention to you, you know, is like, for being naughty, you know, that you're not getting the attention for the things that you feel you should be, which is like you're smart or you're clever or you're interesting or you're interested in this thing or whatever. It's like, oh, you don't suffer fools like that. Like the narrative in your own family of origin is like, you know, mine was like, oh, I'm loud and obnoxious. Mm. And it's like, oh, well, I'm other things too, guys.
But also, like, I always found that I was not aiming for that at all. You know, like I was going out there trying to be really charming and lively and fun, and then that would get read as obnoxious and overbearing and, yeah, loud or whatever, erratic, I don't know.
Right.
And you'd be like, well, how do I bridge that gap between how I'm trying to behave and how it's always received? And I actually still feel like that quite often now. I still sometimes get reactions and I think, wow, that is not how I read this situation. But I remember my careers teacher, like we'd filled in a little questionnaire and I'd ticked, you know, always tries to please people. And she, you know, in front of the whole class said, I would not have had you down as someone that was trying to do that, Catherine. Like, I always thought, you know, you were deliberately trying to be different. And
yes!
And it was like, oh, God, and it was devastating. I felt really wounded by that, you know, this idea that I was deliberately trying to annoy them all. But then I think that's people's way of putting it on you rather than them. Like, you have tried to upset them rather than them not accepting you being a bit different to the mainstream. I mean, I don't know about you, but getting my diagnosis and understanding more about myself has made me more generous to other people, because actually I have made some of the same assumptions in the past, and I would be lying if I said that I've always been saintly about it. And, you know, like, now I'm much more likely than I was previously to think, okay, Lauren's talking really loudly. Maybe she has a hearing difficulty. Maybe she's really excited. Maybe she's neurodivergent like me. Maybe she's had quite a lot of coffee. I'm not going to judge it. And it's actually really easy to step back and to decenter yourself from it. Like, this is not about Lauren attacking me. This is about Lauren being something that I wasn't quite expecting, but okay, let's go with that. I mean, it's actually quite simple when you start to practice it, but it takes a bit to get there.
Right. There's some amount of grace, I think, that can kind of come not just towards the world around you, but also to yourself.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, did you find after the diagnosis, like, you were gentler, kinder, you know, more forgiving with yourself?
Oh, absolutely. And I always say that, you know, Wintering is the book that I could only write after I'd gone through the period of discovery that I document in Electricity, because, yeah, like, reevaluating myself through kinder eyes was, I mean, absolutely life-changing. And it meant that, A, I stopped thinking that I was a terrible person, and I started having an explanation for the times when I, like, failed in public or whatever. But also that I could just start adapting to meet my own needs, and that quite often when stuff went really badly for me, I could see that it was because I'd pushed myself past what was comfortable or what was manageable for me. You know, like, I'd put myself in a very noisy environment, or I'd worked for too long and had too many conversations in the day. Or there was one incident that I keep remembering where I lost my temper at work. And at the time I had a really itchy label in the back of my dress, and I'd always, because that's huge when you're autistic. It sounds tiny, but it's massive. And I remember being in this quite tense conversation and feeling this label and feeling this label and feeling this label, and it felt like it was burning through my skin. And I reached back, and as I was talking, I ripped it out of my dress just at the time when I was, like, offending someone. And it was this moment of this complete loss of control that I felt so humiliated for afterwards, because it looked like I'd got so angry I'd torn my clothing. And it was actually the other way around, that I was so overwhelmed by this really, really itchy label that I couldn't control, I couldn't self-regulate. And that's such a distillation of what it is to be autistic, like losing your self-regulation because you're totally overwhelmed by something that other people will think is minute.
Exactly.
And, like, getting my diagnosis, that was the thing, that was one of the first things that I kept going back to, that moment. It was so telling for me suddenly. But as I got older, I got better at suppressing those dysregulated moments, but it meant that I got sick instead, you know, so it meant that I would suddenly get an absolutely terrible headache, or I would have to take to my bed the next day, or, you know, like, it internalized it, and of course affected my mental health very badly. So you kind of don't win either way until you're able to take control of your own self-regulation, really. And that's a game changer. But I look back on some moments in my life and I think, I understand that now, but wow, I was as baffled as everyone else was by that behavior in that moment. I didn't have any way of explaining it.
Right, right. I think for you know, when I started thinking about autism, I was like, my gosh, if I do an accounting of all of the outsized reactions that I've had to things, it should have been obvious, but no one thinks of it as you having big feelings or you have that you have a challenge regulating your big feelings. Mm. It's that like you're being obstreperous, that you're being difficult, or, you know, recalcitrant or whatever. It's just like, it's always on you as opposed to, you know, having some empathy around like, okay, clearly this isn't typical behavior. And so this person is clearly going through something. And it's interesting. I mean, do you find that now that you have been diagnosed, so you've been public about your diagnosis, that people around you are like, oh, okay, I get it now. Or are they still like, what is her problem?
I mean, half and half, honestly. And I think a lot depends on the individual's understanding of autism, you know, because for some people, it makes them really angry because as far as they're concerned, what autism is like a non-speaking child who they would consider to be like intellectually disabled and like unable to communicate or to do any work. And, you know, like that's it's an inaccurate understanding of autism for so many reasons anyway. Mm-hmm. But what they, you know, so then when they hear me say I'm autistic, they think it's some bizarre play for attention and, you know, find it offensive almost, you know, like I'm trying to steal oxygen from people who need it.
Right, right. I mean, I've noticed that, like, so, I mean, I had the experience of coming out as gay. And
yeah, you've come
out twice. It was pretty easy. Well, it was pretty easy. I mean, except with my parents. Like, when I told my mom that I was gay, she said, whatever. And that wasn't, like, the best response. But everybody generally in my life has been, like, fine. I mean, my brother, like, I told my brother first, like, he doesn't care. Like, my parents just generally, like, and friends, I mean, whatever. Now most of my friends are queer people or queer adjacent people, you know. And so it's not a big deal. But I think that, but everybody knows what it means to be gay. If you say I'm gay, people get it. Yes. I mean, people don't know what it means to be autistic. But I wonder, like, how you have both dealt with, you know, your own personal revelation and your own personal truth, but then also educating people about what that means more globally.
Yeah.
You know,
I mean, it's such a massive issue because, yeah, you're absolutely right. Like, if you say you're gay, people understand what gay means. If you say you have schizophrenia, there's a stable definition of that. But with autism, there isn't even a stable definition in the psychological literature at the moment. I mean, it's not even just like that folk understanding diverges from, you know, medical understanding or psychiatric understanding or psychological understanding or however you want to put it. It's that actually, if you ask people working in the field at the moment, they feel like the definition is thrown up in the air as well, because they're beginning to understand that they were working on the wrong paradigms before, and they were working on these, you know, external observation modalities that were based on, you know, like the research was done on 8-year-old white boys, middle class boys in particular as well. And the assumption was they were likely to be nonverbal. And it's so hard to be part of remaking that definition, because I do feel like I'm part of that in a very kind of crowdsourced way. I mean, like, I would love to say that I'm going out there boldly and explaining my autism to everyone, but I still mask it a lot in situations where it doesn't feel safe and where I can't can't trust that understanding to be there.
Right.
But I've been working on a page on my website recently. I thought about it and I thought, I need to write my own definition of autism as I understand it right now, because there's no one source that I can even turn to quote. And that's where we are right now. And it's a difficult place to be, but it's also quite an exciting place to be. You know, the debate is happening. And finally, we are being part of that debate. And yeah, we're learning. And it's, you know, what we understand as autism now will not be the same in 20 years' time. We need to know that, you know, we need to know that we do not fully get this yet. And there's much more to discover and there's much more to pin down and to unpick. And so, yeah, I think sometimes I do sit down and explain to people, but I do find it exhausting. And I am increasingly kind to myself about not feeling like I've got to be responsible for every ignorant person's understanding of what autism is, you know. but I also wanted to contribute my own definition as I understand it at the moment. And to, you know, like, I equally feel compassion for people who have come in, have stumbled into this world and don't understand it. So where does that leave them? Like, how can I help them to come to a more generous realization about what autism actually is? It's so tricky.
That's a lot. That's a lot of weight, because it's hard, because, I mean, I know this, I keep comparing it to like gayness or whatever, but in the early days, like, I mean, in probably like 2000, you know, when I was in a workplace and people knew that I was gay, like the comments that I would get would be like shocking. Even then, even like just 20 years ago, like, you know, people just were so weird. And I thought, you know, is it my job
To like educate them,
fix your homophobia? Like, is it my job, or can I just like live my life? Can I just like, can I just show up as my authentic self? And in that way, that is my advocacy. In that way, that is the way that I'm helping, is by just being open about who I am, but not having to like fix everyone else. I don't know. It feels really tricky.
It is tricky. And I, you know, like, I think you have to remind yourself that you are not the homophobe whisperer. Like, it's not your job to coax them into
I wish I was I wish I was the homophobe puncher. I wish I was the homophobe kicker, you know.
Carry that, it's too much. But like, I also, so yeah, so I let myself off, and I try and be part of the bigger debate rather than the micro debate, because it's those micro debates that are so exhausting. But I also well, I suppose two things. One is that I refuse to do press that is going to be about, you know, like challenging my right to exist, you know. And I won't do press with people who are anti-vaxxers, for example, because in a very real sense, they want me eradicated from the gene pool. And I am not, I don't have to sit at a table with those people. It's not reasonable for my mental health to do that. But I also flip it back on myself a little and try and remind myself of the gaps in my knowledge and understanding, you know, like,
absolutely.
Do I understand what it is to be Black and autistic? You know, do I understand what it is to be trans and autistic? That's a really common combination. Do I understand what it is to be nonverbal autistic? You know, so I try and remind myself of the ways that I need to listen harder to, in the way that I want people to listen to me.
Right, right. Well, I've been sort of thinking a lot about my own ableism, and how in my mind, like when I was first thinking about autism, I was like, I can't be autistic. I own a home and I have a house.
I own a home
and I have a job, and like I have a partner, and like I'm totally normal. And it's like, why do you think that those things don't go along with a disability? Like, what are you? And I think you're right. It's like, the combinations and the intersectionality of all of this is, you know, much more complicated than, you know, just some white ladies who think differently.
Yeah, no, you know? That's so, like, so true. And
not to minimize, not to minimize.
But we can do this in relative safety, right? We can have these conversations because of the kind of jobs that we're in, and because we're white, and, you know, because we're relatively middle class, or what, you know, whatever it is, like, it's a privilege to be able to have these conversations, and other people out there wouldn't feel safe to do this, you know. And that's that's something that I think we often need to bear in mind, because I think it's really easy for us to erase other people within this very, very fragile community. And I'm you know, I haven't always been as conscious of that as I am at this point, and I hope I get more conscious about it as I go along.
Right. I learned so many things from your book, but one thing was the Maori word for autism, Takewatanga. Yeah. The idea of your own time and space. And you know, and you have this like, you have this beautiful line that like you yearn for that place, you know, without having ever known it yourself. And like, can you get there at this point in your life? Can you find your own time and space now, or is it too late? And I wonder if you've answered that for yourself.
A little more, yeah. And I think I am beginning, it's almost a bit like learning to take up the space that you need. Like it all comes together for me into this idea that I need to be allowed to take up my shape of space in the world, and that might be a different shape to other people's. And I'm getting better at it. And I have to enter into it quite mindfully to remind myself of what I feel like I need, because having suppressed it for so long, I'm not always aware of it myself, you know. And I feel like I'm growing into it, and I feel like I'm making more and more changes to my life that mean I can live in exactly the way that I want to and need to. But it's definitely a work in progress, and I think it will be forever.
What are those changes? I'm curious.
Well, you know, I stopped working in the university that I was working in when I was writing Electricity. And I began to think about how I wanted to shape my days and how often I wanted to be in silence, how often I wanted to walk and get outside, like how often I wanted to actually socialize, what the balance was in the way that I even practiced my writing, you know, because for me, it's not all about output. It's about the pleasure of obsessing over certain things and inputting and sort of drinking in information in that very autistic, information hungry way.
Right.
But, you know, also I increasingly try and explain what I need in the moment to people, you know, and say, I'm finding this really noisy right now. I'm really sorry. I'm going to have to step outside, or would you mind turning it down, or, you know, whatever that particular issue is at the time. And I am getting better at just trying to simply state my needs. But it's very imperfect still. And I still regularly find myself suppressing that need because, you know, out of sheer embarrassment or politeness or, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
The embarrassment. I mean, or like somebody else is going to be put out. I mean, I remember one time a lady was like bouncing her foot up and down on this chair, like the leg of a chair, and the chair leg was broken and it was making terrible, terrible scratching noises, but she couldn't hear it because she had her headphones in. And so I thought it was totally reasonable to just go over and be like, hey, I'm not sure if you know, but the chair's broken and it's making this noise. And she looked at me like I had five eyeballs. And she was like, she was basically like with her eyes saying like, go back to your seat right now. And so I feel like I'm getting to this point where there's a lot of work to just like, one, recognize the trigger, and two, fix it for yourself, because there is embarrassment because people don't know. I mean, I often think like if I get on an airplane and I get put on a window seat, which I can't sit in, and I say to the flight attendant, like in my fantasy autism land, I say to the flight attendant, I'm not going to be able to sit there because I'm autistic and I have extreme panic around these particular spaces. Yeah. And if you could just move me to an aisle. And she would say, oh, absolutely. I'm so happy to help you.
But back in the real world.
Right. And so one episode is that autism fantasy land. Like, what would your autistic fantasy land look like, where like you could move through your day without any hitches of any kind? Like for Catherine, what would it look like?
Like everywhere would be quiet. Nobody would be wearing strong perfume. Nobody would touch me, like barge into me in the street or like tap me on the shoulder to get my attention, or I hate that. But actually, it would probably mostly take place in a cabin in the woods completely on my own. So, you know, but it's really interesting you raise that, because I do think that within the autistic community, we can like get into the headspace of thinking that that world is possible, you know, like if only the world would adapt to us. And I think we have to question that a little bit, because I think there's like a halfway point that we need to find.
So, I mean, you're some years out from your diagnosis. Mm. I'm like 1 year out. I wonder like where you are now. Mm. You've written a book, you've processed this, you've written two books, you had a massive hit, you know, which might not have anything to do with, you know, autism, but I mean, it probably changed a lot of things for you. Like, where are you now?
Well, I mean, I think like one of the things is I'm kind of post obsession with it. Like I've absorbed a lot about it, and the obsession with it has waned. Like I've got to the point where I just want to live as the person I am, and not have to constantly reflect on it. And every now and then I'm reminded of my differences in a way that really surprises me. Like I've made so many changes to my life now that it's often invisible to me that I am, you know, different in any way at all. Like I don't have to bang my head up mm-hmm. against it every day like I used to. And every now and then, like my level of sort of disability in the world really shocks me. I'm kind of really confronted by it. And I find it almost quite upsetting all over again, you know, like, oh, wow, I can't deal with this. Oh, God, you know, I thought I was kind of fine forever now. and that, like, in lots of ways, that's kind of a nice place to be. It's nicer than it sounds, because it means that most of the time things are working. You know, I have to really remind myself that I am in need of support sometimes, and that I deserve to access it. Electricity came out in the UK, I think, 2018, so nearly 4 years ago. Mm-hmm. And so it's been quite strange to return to talking to it now that the US edition has been released, because I felt almost bodily reluctant to return to talking about that stuff, if I'm honest. It felt kind of exhausting to trawl back there, and my brain was very reluctant to go there. But it's actually been really good for me to start talking about it again. And like that feeling of how far you've traveled, and that feeling of changes that you've cemented into you that you hadn't noticed even happening. And the feeling that you have something to pass on to the next generation of people coming through. I think that's a really wonderful place to be, actually. So yeah, I'm proudly and happily autistic, and I don't have the doubts that I once had of the imposter syndrome, certainly.
Catherine May is the New York Times bestselling author of Wintering: The Power of Rest and Retreat in Difficult Times, and The Electricity of Every Living Thing: A Woman's Walk in the Wild to Find Her Way Home. She lives in Whitstable on the Kentish coast of England. You can find her online at catherine-may.co.uk. This episode was produced by David Jha and edited by Sophie Crane. Mix engineering by Jake Gorski. Special thanks to Lisa Dunn for booking help. And thanks to you, friend, for listening.
I'm Ben Natifafri, host of the history show The Last Archive. And I want to tell you about a new series we're running in our feed. It's called The Deadline. Six essays written and read by Jill Lepore, the New Yorker writer, American historian, and founding host of our show. These are incredible essays on everything from the history of cryogenics to the Silicon Valley gospel of disruption. And at the end of each essay, I interview Jill about her craft as a writer. You can listen on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.